Wolf Hawk? You heard my name, I live in Nanuet.
I'm a retired civil trial attorney from New Jersey. Former World War II combat soldier, you heard, under General Patton. And a liberator. I wear this cap whenever... One time? Some of the schools, they go on and off. I hope that doesn't happen. That drives me crazy. I wear this cap whenever I speak. It's a personal thing. No sleeping, please. Sit up. 71st Division is my outfit, and I wear it because it just makes me feel connected to some of my buddies who were less fortunate than me and never got back home. Whenever I speak, I just wear the cap if anybody's interested. My talk is in two parts. First is about me, a boy, a student like you all, a soldier, soldier in combat, etc., etc. So you get to know me. And the second part and the main focus is what happened when this young soldier became a concentration camp liberator. I'm known to tell it like it is. I know this is I don't usually speak to very orthodox like this group. I hope I don't offend anybody. I'm an old infantry grunt. I use words, they pop out of my mouth, so I'm a little nervous here because I hope you kids can tolerate. I'm not going to change anything. The teachers tell me to say it like it is, and that's what I do. So if I do say anything that offends the rabbi or Connor, any, I apologize in advance, but you're going to have to deal with it. I'm graphic. I just told a young girl here, please, this is a heavy subject. I don't see any chewing. I tell this in Westchester, the mouth's going a mile a minute. And if you have to yawn, if you haven't been told, you're old enough, you guys, please put your hand over your mouth. I don't want to see your tonsils. I'm not interested. So I always start out by stating that for over 50 years after the end of World War II, I didn't speak to anybody about my experiences in combat or as a liberator. Nobody. My mother, father, brother, girlfriends, later my wife, children, grandchildren, nobody. 50 years. The reason was that I was very fearful of bringing back those very frightening and disturbing memories that I had when the war ended. And I mean frightening and disturbing nightmares. I remember I was a member of the Army of Occupation when the war ended. And I remember not being able to sleep. When I tried to sleep, I would get up sweating and crying and shouting and cursing. And I used to walk the streets. I remember in Austria and Germany, 3, 4, 5 in the morning, couldn't sleep. And at times I thought I was going crazy. That's not easy to say. It was a very difficult time. I'm sure I had PTSD. Do you all know what PTSD? You should have been old enough to know. That's post-traumatic stress disorder. They didn't know what that was in World War II. We never heard that term. The only term I remember is they would go shell shock. And this meant like you were something wrong with you. You were crazy. And they didn't know what that was and didn't know how to treat it. And if you didn't fight your way through it, you'd be sent away somewhere you wouldn't want to go to. So I just figured I'm not going to talk about it. It was like I took a key and I locked up that part of my brain, threw the key away. I wasn't going to find it. And I didn't. And anybody asked me about what I did in the war, I'd say, well, I did my job and I changed the subject and I didn't go into it. 50 years, that's a long time. And then I came up to Rockland County. I'm a Jersey boy. And a lady by the name of Barbara Grau at the time was the executive director of the local Holocaust Museum in Spring Valley, which, by the way, we're now over at Suffern at Rockland Community College. I hear the phone ring. I said, "Mr. Moskin, yes. Is it true? Somebody told me you were a soldier with General Patton. Is that correct?" I said, "Yes," and I was kind of shaky. This is 1995, 50 years after the end of the war in Europe. "Were you with Patton as a liberator?" I said, "Yes." "Oh, boy, now I got somebody to talk to, the middle school and the high school." I said, "No, you do not," and I hung up the phone. And I was rude, but I was just kind of shook up. But she was very persistent in a nice way and kept calling me. And finally she said to me, "Why don't you just try it, Mr. Moskin, once at the old Nanuet Mall, you know, the mall before it went down, now it's back up again. And if it's too much for you, I'll never ask you to speak again." So I was nervous, but I said, "Okay." And I spoke for the first time on June 10, 1995, 50 years after the end of the war. Baby, I was dead wrong. It was like a catharsis. It was like a, well, you guys wouldn't know what catharsis. Anybody know what catharsis is? It's like a purging. It's like a getting all that stuff out of you. It just came out of me. It flowed, and it turned out to be a good thing. I was like my own psychiatrist, you know, all that stuff coming out, talking. And man, I was amazed. And baby, I've been a busy boy since June 10, 1995. I'd spoken in 10 different states, last count over 125 middle school, high schools, to a lot of television, Jewish Americans. My daughters tell me I'm all over the internet, you know. I'm not into technology, but I guess you guys are. My grandchildren, 8 years old, it's very embarrassing. They come here, Pop, I'll show you what to do. But I think, well, I don't want to get into it. See, that's why I have these notes, because I go all over the place. I'm not into this social media with you. God, Mike, they never take their eyes off that stuff. I can't. I'm a blabbermouth. You see, I like to talk. But I'll speak anywhere now, as I said. I it's a calling with me now. I want to reach as many of you young people as I can while I got the strength. And I'm one of the lucky ones that can, my age can stand up here and still blabber. A lot of the guys my age are less fortunate than me and don't hear and don't walk well. And I guess maybe God's looking down on me, had his hand on my shoulder. But let me give you a brief personal background. I was born in Englewood, New Jersey. As I said, I'm a Jersey boy originally, May 30th, 1926. And my math is correct, and I was always pretty good in math. I'll be 89 on my next birthday. And every time I say that, I say, "Oh, my God, me? Oh." Is that somebody else? Can't be. Because when I was your age, baby, nobody lived. 70 was old. I lived in a very ethnic neighborhood in the 4th Ward in Englewood, New Jersey. Best thing ever happened to me. Father was a pharmacist, later became the mayor of Englewood. And I don't know, when I think back how it happened, but in the 2 or 3 blocks, it was probably the poorer ward near Teaneck. You know, Jewish kids like myself, Catholic, Protestant, Italian, Irish, a couple of Asian boys, Hispanic, and Indian. I've never seen anything like it since that in a 2 or 3 block, it was like such a mix. We all played in the streets together. We all walked this, by the way. We didn't have buses then. You bus here too? Everywhere I go with the buses. We walked a couple of miles. We loved it. Oh, you know, nice weather, you took bicycles. Everybody knew each other. We all got along together. Everybody's mother knew it. The houses were very close together. I could look in the kitchen, you know, and the next door neighbors and the Greensteins. But I don't remember any hate or prejudice or bigotry, any of that stuff. If it was there, I sure heck didn't see it. I learned as I got older, unfortunately, not everybody felt that way. By the way, mothers all cook dinner then. And, you know, I'm finding out that dinner time, the fathers, you know, mothers didn't work outside the house then, that I recall. Fathers worked. Fathers came home to dinner. We had nothing but a radio, and we sat at a dinner table. What did you do in school today? God forbid if you brought a note home. I understand teachers can't do that today. I don't know how you can be a teacher today. I mean, everything is, oh, can't do that. I speak to my cousin who said, that's harassment. Harassment? Can't send him back in the room. Can't take him to the principal's office. Can't send a note home. Alan was acting. I said, well, that's discipline. That's not harassment. I'm deviating. I gotta watch. At any rate, it was the best thing ever happened to me. I learned from the Fourth Ward in Englewood that what Maya Angelou, my favorite poet, said, people are more alike than different. We all feel pain. We all feel joy. It doesn't make any difference what your religion, what the color of your skin is. I don't know why that can't enter in people's noggin. Went through the Englewood school system. They skipped me. I never went to fourth grade. They skipped me from third to fifth. They must have thought I had something upstairs. I never liked it because I was a very good athlete. I guess today they call him a jock. I was three letter. And when you're younger, you know, I wasn't the tallest guy in the outfit, so I had to be better than the other guys. So I was always a little, I got to watch my language here, but let's say annoyed. But when I hit 17, 2 weeks after my 17th birthday, I went up to the Q's up at Syracuse University, started college. And 1 year later, I got a draft notice. You all know what a draft notice was in World War II? You shake your head, the pretty girl in the white. What was a draft notice? That's you. If you said yes, you better be know the answer. I wasn't talking to you, but you can answer. That's okay. You got white on them, too. What was the draft notice?
Me?
Yes, you.
When they tell you you have to come to the army?
That's pretty good. You got a notice from the government. Today it's a volunteer army. I'm trying to distinguish. Today it's a volunteer army. World War II, everybody got a notice from the government. Never forgot, it was big letters, greetings. You're like, you're going to a bar mitzvah, greetings. But it meant you would report for a physical exam. If you passed the physical, you went in the Army, the Navy, fly boy or Coast Guard or whatever. I went into the United States Army. Went down to Camp Landing, the northern part of Florida, for 3 months of infantry basic training. Infantry basic training, I'll just try to summarize. We're learning how to kill or be killed. How to survive in combat. Now, I was a good athlete, as I told you. Not a goody two-shoes baby boy. I mean, I've been around and went to camp and everything else, but I never had a gun in my hand. And the Southern boys, you know, they were brought up hunting and fishing. That was like a piece of cake for them since they were kids, but well, those northern boys, most of us never had a gun in us. So it was quite a transition from being a student to learning how to shoot an M1 rifle, which was my baby, never left my side. The M1 machine gun, a BAR, which is a Browning automatic rifle, stick a bayonet in somebody's belly. When you want to survive in combat, you got to learn. And I did. Now, I encountered bias. This is not a pretty part of my talk. I tell it because it's the truth, and it kind of had a bearing on me. I was only 18, a young boy. I wasn't prepared for what I encountered in the South. You remember, this was 1944. Got along with all the Southern boys initially because, as I said, I was a good athlete, you know, and talked about girls and sports, so I had no problem talking with other guys and getting along. But I put a picture behind my bunk. We won the sectionals in Bergen County. I was a little point guard basketball. And, you know, when you win afterwards, they take a picture. This was in Trenton, New Jersey, where we played. And there were three colored kids. By the way, we used the word colored then. And my oldest daughter, with her political correctness, drives me crazy. But we didn't use the word black. I never heard it. But now black. But colored was the word. That was not a bad word. my best friend was a colored boy, George. He grew up together when we were 3 years old. He, myself, two other colored boys, and our big Roman Catholic senator, Billy O'Malley, you know, anybody? Oh, you're all girls here. What am I talking? Well, you girls play basketball too, right? Well, I don't know if you follow the sports, but he, our senator, he was 6 feet tall, and we thought, what a giant, my God. What a rebounder, 6 feet. When I think back now, I mean, these little point guards are 6'6", 6'8". And I was only about 5'7", or 5'8", but I was fast. So, you know, you have your arms around. I say, take a picture. That's how we're standing, each one with their arm. Well, I put that picture behind my bunk. The Southern boys were walking by, but boop, boop, beep, beep, beep. I don't know what they're mumbling and talking about. Hey, college boy, they look at me. Is that you in that picture? Is that college boy was my nickname. You know, because we all had nicknames, and I can tell you mine was one of the better ones. But well, mine was college boy. That's you? I said, yeah, what? I told him what I just told you. You got your arms around that nigger? That nigger baboon? I said, what? First of all, he's talking about my best friend, George. You know, I never heard something like that. You don't know me too well, though. I'm known to be feisty. That's the word I'll use. I'm not violent. I never start anything, but I don't back off either. So I was ready to go, baby, when I heard that. And I don't mean to the bathroom. And all the northern boys say, hey, take it easy. Take it easy. They're ignorant. They're stupid. Don't get excited. So I let it go. But every day on the assignment board where we got, latrine duty or guard duty in big red letters, the favorite term was masking the nigger lover. That's the term they used. I was a nigger lover. And then later I was called a kike. And a sheeny. I don't know if you guys know what language they use today, but let me put it this way. They're not very endearing terms if you're Jewish. And I'm getting hot under the collar, and finally whoever wants to meet me reveille the next morning, let's go. And those days we fought with fists. We didn't have knives and guns like the crazies today in schools in New York, whatever I'm hearing. But so there were some fisticuffs. And I'm not going to get into all the violence. I'm just saying that sometimes there's a point in my judgment that you don't back off and you can't take things. And they never messed with me, the Southern boys, after that. I mean, and I'm just going to preface this. When I was in combat, I got none of that garbage. I loved every one of my buddies in the 71st Division. We didn't care if you're Catholic, Jewish, pink, yellow. You protect my right flank and I'll protect your left. That's all we cared about. So don't misunderstand when I talk about it. This was the South, right? And I never fought with any of those guys because we all went in different directions after you finished basic training. But the reason I tell that, and I encountered some Southern boys up at the Coast Guard Academy a year or two ago when I spoke, came up to me, Mr. Moskin, you're a great speaker. But why did you have to go into it? I said, hey, you guys weren't even born then. I'm not putting the sins of the father on you, but I'm saying, I was upset because we're the good guys. We're going to fight the Nazis, the bad guys. And I got guys on my side talking about niggers and kikes. And I said, well, is this America? By the way, I rode by in a bus when I had a pass. And it was like a big country club, a whole block with a big banner around it, a big white banner. And in black letters, and I'll never forget it, looking out the bus window. No colored dash, no Jews dash, no dogs in here. I said, what the, is this America? I didn't like it then, I don't like it now. It's a bunch of hooey, and I get upset even thinking about it. Now, this was the 40s, I'm not saying today. After the completion of basic training, 3 days at home, shipped overseas in what's called the Liberty Ship Convoy. Oh, man, those Liberty ships, they were like rowboats in the ocean. I'm getting nauseous even talking about it. Some of the guys went over on the Queen Elizabeth, I think. What a lucky SOBs. But we went on Liberty Ship Convoy. And man, everybody was on all fours and going from both ends. It wasn't pretty. Get us off this ship. And we finally landed in Liverpool, England. Went across the channel into France, into what's called a replacement camp, where you get sent up to the front line. And I got sent up to join the 66th Infantry Regiment, 71st Infantry Division, part of the famous Third Army, led by General George S. Patton himself. And you want to have me come back? I'll talk about 2 hours on General Patton. But great general militarily, but as a human being, we all thought he was a wacko, I'll be honest with you. My captain was very friendly with me, even though I was an enlisted. I was only a private initially, then went up the rank. But he used to tell me about Patton, and I scared the heck out of me. I thought he was Napoleon reincarnated and all kinds of crazy things. But as a general, we'd follow him anywhere. But just, I think he was a little, up and down the elevator too much or something. At any rate, our outfit fought in places like Coburg, Bayreuth, Amberg, Bamberg, Nuremberg, Straubing. A lot of those German towns always ended up with a Berg, I remember. And every one of these battles, the Rhineland campaign, the Central European campaign, I lost a lot of my very close buddies. Too many. I'm just one of the lucky ones. I don't know why I'm here sometimes. I was 100 meters to the right, 100 meters to the left, I wouldn't be standing here. So maybe, I don't know, maybe there is a higher power. Sometimes I think this is one of the nightmares I went through for a long time. I'm going to touch a little bit on combat. I usually do this mostly for the boys because they, they're into that stuff. They think, I'm going to tell you right now, you girls, what I tell the boys. Being in combat is like being a hell and back. Nothing macho and nothing heroic. I never saw a hero and I never saw an atheist. I'll tell you that in a foxhole. Second day I was on the front line. Krauts are throwing all mortars and artillery. I think it was outside Bamberg. And all of a sudden something hit the top of my head. I'm in the hole, and I reach up, and I pull down, just like this. I'm holding a blood-soaked arm. And on the wrist is an eagle. And I start screaming, Wiltsie, 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 damn it, because Wiltsie had an eagle tattooed on his wrist. And he was going to soar like an eagle after the war. And I just talking to Wiltsie. About 15 minutes before, and I'm holding his blood-soaked arm. You think that doesn't shake you up? I'm just an 18-year-old kid. A couple of weeks later, my best friend, best soldier I ever knew, TR from a little town outside Detroit, Michigan. Man, we were so close, And when you're in combat 24 hours a day and you're living with somebody and you see your buddies dying, every other minute, you talk about family and sports and girls, and you heard the term band of brothers. I mean, there's a reason. It's like I tell my brother, I love my brother, but it's a different type of relationship. And he was always trying to help the rooks. The rooks are the rookies. The first day you're on the front line, man, you're scared. Anybody tells me a soldier wasn't scared is a... He wasn't scared. He's a liar, a moron, or a jackass, or a combination of all three. You're scared, baby, the first time you're on the line. Well, hell's breaking loose. And T.R. was always out trying to help the new guys. Go here, go there, left flank. And I kept telling him, T.R., you got to watch yourself. Because he would stay up too long. And this time, outside Regensburg, the Krauts again were throwing, was near, everything was blowing up all around us. And I look up, and the sergeant says, hit the hole. That means go down. When you hear the incoming, you get the sound, it has a sound to it. And just before I went down, I look and I see TR again directing the new guys, right flank, left flank. Well, I went down the hole, and about a minute or two later, when it lit up a little bit, I look up, I don't see my best buddy, and I knew damn well that wasn't a good sign. And I ran as fast as I could, 100 meters roughly to my right. And then I see him, and he's like a crater, and he's back against the crater. And his right leg is about 15 feet away from his body, and his insides are all over the place. And man, I almost fainted looking at that. And when I got close, he said, he called me Allie. Everybody called me College Boy, but he always called me Allie, Allie. I'm numb, can you help me? I'm numb, can you help me? And I put my helmet under his chin. I didn't want him to look down. I didn't want him to see what I had seen. And because you go into shock, you know, when soldiers go into shock, that's bad news, baby. You get to know the look. And I start screaming, medics. I remember, medics, even medics, medics. And I knew there was nothing a medic could do, but you know, you do things by instinct. And then the sergeant says, come on, College Boy, get your rear end up for. We're not allowed to stay back with the wounded. Those are the orders. You got to let the medics do their job. And so I had to leave my best friend dying in a filthy damn hole in Germany, and something you don't get over. You don't get over something like that ever. And then the lieutenant asked me if I wanted to write the letter to TR's mom, because he knew how close you are. And, I want to tell you, three nights in a foxhole with a flashlight and a crayon and toilet paper, anything I got right on, I wrote pretty well. And Lieutenant transcribed it and sent it back to his mom, and we became pretty close after the war. He used to go out to his hometown for many years till his mother passed away about 20 years ago. And I still think about him a lot. 19, to die like that. And the last thing, I'll get off this. I was a scout. Scouts go in ahead of the main outfit to make sure we don't get ambushed by the Krauts. By the way, if I use the word Krauts, that's the German. We had nicknames, Jerry's, Krauts, and others that I'm not going to tell you. Near the end of the war, we were encountering a lot of these. I'll touch on them in a moment. The Hitler Youth. I don't know if you studied about Hitler Jugend or Hitler Youth. We didn't. But we were scouts going ahead. As I said, they teamed me up with Santana Rios. I was the brain. When you're scouts, they team two of you to go ahead to make sure we don't get ambushed when the main outfit comes ahead. We came under fire from a second floor ledge. I can't think of the town anymore. But my buddy was out in the open, Santana. I got behind a Panzer tank. Perpetrator didn't see me, but he saw my buddy. While he came out to shoot at my buddy, I saw him, got a few rounds off with my M1. I was lucky. I made a hit, falls to the ground, and I run up. Santana runs up, no pulse, dead soldier, look down at the ground. Handsome, blonde, blue-eyed. That's why I beat the gun a little bit, but we couldn't figure how he looked so young. And so later we realized that this was what a member, in retrospect, I didn't know at the time, of the Hitler Youth. They all looked alike. They were like blonde and blue-eyed, fanatical, full of hate. I think it was the beginning, in my judgment, of Hitler, or the cloning of, you know, the pure Aryan race, and they're handpicking these Hitler Youth out. But near the body was a helmet. Inside the helmet was a picture of an elderly man and woman, probably in the 40s and 50s. I'm smiling because when I say elderly, you know, when you're 18, somebody 40 and 50 is old to you. Now it's half my age, so it's very young. But I say elderly in the eyes of an 18-year-old. A picture of a man and a woman, and underneath it was a Wir liebe dich, Mutti und Vati scribbled. I think it's more German than, you know, we love you, mom and dad. I knew what that meant. And even though the rational part of my brain knew this was the enemy, he would have blown me away if he saw me behind the tank. I knew all that. that I kill this young teenage boy, not going home to that lady and man in the helmet and picture. Man, that upset me. Took me over and over. I kept thinking, I kill a boy, not going home. I did my share. I was a good soldier. I killed plenty. But I never enjoyed it one damn minute, I can tell you that. Killing is not something I enjoyed. It left a mark on me. Before I get into the main focus, let me just touch on the Hitler Youth. As I said, near the end of the war, we were taking a lot of prisoners, a lot of these Hitler Youth. And remember this one day, we had this big blonde, six foot was very big that those days. As I told you, another blonde, blue-eyed, we had him shackled like this, arms behind, ankles. And I was standing about over here, and he was going this way, and he made a right turn. This was near the end of April 45, a couple of weeks near the end of the war. He looked at me, came right up to me this close, and he starts screaming, Schweinhund, Schweinhund, Amerikaner Schweinhund, and starts spitting in my face. And I'm looking at the hate in his face, and the saliva's coming down my cheek. And then I got... Starts with a P, pissed. I don't know whether you kids, I got to watch my language or worse than that, but I was upset. I've been on the line a long time, and I saw my buddies. I don't think I had slept for 36 hours. I lost a lot of my close buddies, and this young punk is spitting in my face and cursing me. I didn't know exactly what it meant, but I knew it wasn't a pleasantry, I can tell you that. I think literally it means swine dog, or somebody told me it's German slang. Schweinhund, dog, swine or something. I took my M1 rifle, which I told you was right here, baby, on my side. Never, I was glued to my hip. I picked it up, and he's standing there next to me, and I, as we're trained, I put it right up to his, right over the right ear where the right temple is, and just took the rifle, took the trigger off, had him just like that. And then the major starts screaming, college boy, damn it. Don't be doing that in front of me. Don't be doing that. You can't do that in front of me. I'll GCM you. College boy, put it down. GCM is a general court martial. And I came so close to blowing that hateful young Nazi away. And I thank God for the major. I put the rifle down, I kicked him in the butt, cursed him in English, and back of the line, you wouldn't know. But I tell it because my life, I wouldn't be here. I'd be in Leavenworth if I were, who knows, the rest of my life. Came so close. But what I remember is the hate. The hate, God forbid if he knew I was Jewish. The hate for an American soldier. The two elements that I always remember, the Hitler Youth and the Waffen-SS, they were the real Nazis. And the Waffen-SS, the lousy cowards. Five of my buddies, they took prisoner. We found them the next day, each one with a bullet in the back of the neck. You think we were going to take those guys prisoners after that? The media can take, don't get me started. They can take a jump somewhere. They don't know about things that I'm talking about. I'm down on the media plenty, and I'm not going to get into all that stuff. Now let me get to the main focus, because I've been, Connor says I got time here, so sometimes they give me 30 minutes. I can't go into the stuff I'm going today. Thank God. I like to give you the whole picture. Now the main focus of why I'm here. Around the beginning of May 1945, we came across a POW camp near Lombach in Austria. A POW camp, prisoner of war camp. Mostly British flyboys. RAFs. Those guys all died with clean underwear. We have fun talking to each other. But. And they were in pretty good shape, a little on the thin side. Thank you, guys. And they were 6 months, 8 months, a year in the camp. For the first time, we heard something like this. Hey, guys, We heard rumors that there's a camp for Jews a few kilometers down the road. We all looked at each other, my boy. Camp for Jews? What do you mean a camp for Jews? I emphasize that because a lot of the kids that I speak to come up to me afterwards and said, you said you didn't know there was, you were perplexed. Didn't you know there were camps for Jews? Didn't you go over to liberate the Jews? No. On our level, we did not know about any concentration camps for Jews. I'm not talking about the mucky mucks, the president, and the up top. I'm talking about my outfit and our guys and my lieutenant. We didn't know about camps for Jews. So when I heard there were camps for Jews, we thought it was a rumor. We weren't sure. We were ordered to go toward Linz in Austria. Still some fighting. This was early May 45. And all of a sudden, I remember a damp day. It wasn't snow because it was May, but it was damp, cloudy. We're walking in the forest. My God, the most offensive, nauseating stench. It was a smell that got into your nostrils, into your brain. Whew, what is that freaking smell? Woo, what a, it's a smell you can never forget. And finally, all of a sudden, through the trees, I remember looking and seeing a big compound, like with barbed wire. And that turned out to be the Gunskirchen Lager, a subcamp of Mauthausen, a concentration camp in Austria. Very little resistance. There was one SS officer, for some reason, wouldn't drop his gun. The interpreter kept saying in German, drop his gun. Either he was trying to be a hero or he was stupid. The captain told me, do my job. He wasn't going to drop his gun, so I had to take care of him, blow him away. That was the last mistake he made. And after that, cut through the barbed wire and entered this camp. And I'm going to tell you, what I saw when we entered that camp was the most horrific sight I've ever seen or ever hoped to see the rest of my life. There was a bunch of skeleton-like bodies on the left and another pile of skeleton-like bodies on the right. When I say skeleton-like, I mean skeleton-like. Bones with no flesh. Those survivors in this camp that were alive were so emaciated it defies description. They weighed 70 pounds, 75. All I remember, I try to visualize and it looked to me like when they were, the ones that could walk were like broomsticks for arms and legs and no flesh. The cheeks all like all hollow out. The sockets, the eyes and the sock back into the sock. They all looked alike. You couldn't distinguish genitalia. I couldn't. They had these filthy, it looked like pajamas, you know, like blue or white or gray stripes, some with the top, some with the bottoms. Many were going, I remember, looking skyward and chanting in prayers and dialects that we didn't understand. Some were crawling. Some were crying. We kept looking at each other and saying, what is going on here? We weren't prepared for this. These were civilians. We had no idea what. Essenbitte, Wasserbitte, Zigarettenbitte, Essenbitte, over and over again. Food, water. I didn't smoke. Some of the guys handed out cigarettes, and you had to visually see people. I watched it. They took the, you know, the wrapping around the tobacco and pull the and start biting into the tobacco to chew the tobacco. I handed out some of my C and K rations, army issue. It was like crackers or cheese or gum or I forget what we had. Spam. And you had to watch, some of them would take the food so fast and start chomping on it. And I'm looking, watching visually what people are starving, what they do. And then the next thing we saw, many would start to grab the esophagus like this. And I said, what? And they were falling to the ground, choking. And then the medic starts screaming, no solid food, darn it, no solid food, because when you starve, apparently, you know, it clamps up. You can't swallow. So I said, oh, my God. You know, it was like we were in a dilemma. I'm trying to help, and then people are choking and falling down. We weren't prepared. It was Panicville. And I remember my captain on, we had walkie-talkies then, screaming, get help up to the rear. Get help up here, damn it. There are people dying up here. People need food up here. Medical, screaming, because sometimes you couldn't get through. You know, it wasn't like technology today. All we had was these walkie-talkies, and sometimes they didn't. It was just chaotic. And then I remember many of them seemed to be frightened of our uniform. And the lieutenant was smart enough to, they don't know who we are. They're half delirious, so they don't know who we are. And somebody said, who's the lieutenant? Start screaming at me. He knew I was Jewish. I think we had one other Jewish boy, Herbie, from Brownsville, or something. I'm not familiar with Brooklyn, somewhere in New York. You can speak Yiddish, speak Yiddish, speak Hebrew. Tell these people we're American soldiers. We'll take care of them. They're free now. It's that screaming. And I remember being so frustrated. I couldn't speak any Hebrew or Yiddish. First of all, when our people, parents, grandparents came from the old country then, you're American now. You speak English. Speak English. They sat at the dinner table with me doing my homework. My grandparents, they want to learn English, and they wouldn't speak, maybe in the bedroom today, but not in front of me. They wanted to learn English. And I tell that up in Westchester, New Rochelle, and Mount Vernon, plenty of these. Like, don't get me started on that. You come to this country, you learn English, speak English. That's how I feel. They don't like it, let them sue me, but that's how I feel. And that's how they did. So I couldn't speak it. I didn't know it. I knew chutzpah, meshugana, you know, but... I knew, but I couldn't, but somehow I was able to say, Ich bin auch Jude. I think it's probably German, I am also a Jew. It just came out of me. Ich bin auch Jude. I must have heard it somewhere. And for the first time, when I said that, there were some smiles at the Gunskirchen lot. I met a kind of soul, I remember this, again, I'm going to say elderly, but I don't know, but it was an older person. And he came up to me, and I was standing there, still a little upset by not knowing whether to try to hand out food to people that were asking for it, and the medics telling me, you can't give them food, only one. But this man came up to me like this, I remember, and he was so frail, a bunch of bones, really, but he had a smile on his face. Yuda, Medicana, Danka, thank you. And then he went down on the ground on his knees, and he started to kiss my boots. My boots were caked with blood and feces and vomit, you know. And I knew he was trying to be affectionate toward me, but it made me very uncomfortable. I never had anybody kind of groveling at my feet, so to speak. You know. So I put my hands on the... You know, under the armpits and pulled him up this way so that the back, he came up this way toward me. And God help me, the smell was so powerful that I wanted to pull away in the worst way. But as he came up, not only that back of the nape of his neck, all the way down, there were these open, festering, pussy sores. Now, I know this is graphic and not pretty, but I'm trying to tell you exactly what I remember. And out of those sores, the open sores, there was lice. There were lice crawling. You can just visualize that. So, God, I want... Whew. But I held my ground, and as I felt him come up, he was crying, and I felt his tears on my cheek, and I just started to cry. I get emotional when I think about it, because the scene I can never, ever forget, how thankful he was to... I kept saying, Danke, thank you, Danke, Danke, Americana soldiers, thank you, thank you. Everywhere you looked in the Gunskirchen Lager was the foul stench of the dead and the dying. Went into the barracks, two layers of bunks, huts, whatever, barracks, people on top of each other like sardines. I hate to use that term, but they were squished on top, many on the ground, dead, piles of dead bodies. The smell, again, was unbearable. And many of them doing this, that were on the bunks. Help me, 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 And we weren't doctors, we were just soldiers. I couldn't stay in there, the smell was so bad, the piles of dead bodies, so came out and start screaming again, medics, medics, get up here, damn medic. And the poor medics, these were just young fellas. To be honest with you, they weren't trained for something like this. They were mostly trained to stick morphine in guys. Well, you guys don't know, but those days, guys bled out, didn't save them like they do today. They amputees all over the place. When I go to the hospital, the VA and Walter Reed, these guys with no arms and legs. Those days, you lost a limb or something. We try to save them with a tourniquet, but many guys bled out and they were in such pain. So the medics were just sticking you with morphine and stop the screaming and the pain. They weren't trained to do what they can do today. But I remember coming out of the barracks and seeing a dead horse off to the right, about 10 feet over here, and I came out and saw three of these inmates with the bark of a tree digging it into the guts of a dead horse. Could hear the ligaments and the bones watching, and then taking the hands and pulling the entrails of a dead horse and starting to chew and bite, and the blood. That's graphic, but I'm telling you, I was looking, I couldn't believe what starvation can do to you. Then I saw a young lad about your age outside the back of the barracks, laying there. He weighed 70 pounds, all bones. A medic was trying to console him. This one medic could speak a little, I didn't know what dialect it was. And he was saying something like he interpreted for me. Why did they do this to me? I'm a good person. Why did they do, just because I'm Jewish, just because I'm Jewish, why did they do this to me? Why did they do this to me? Over and over again. And then his head went down and the medic gave me the no pulse sign. And he was gone. And that's how this young fella died. I always said, how can any, I don't know what I could say to him. I didn't have, could answer him, but he didn't know. Why did they do this to me? Because I'm Jewish. After the war ended in Europe, May of 45, I remained, as I said, as a member of the Army of Occupation. And I saw so many other GIs and guys that liberated other camps like Auschwitz and Dachau and Majdanek and Treblinka and Buchenwald, Bergen-Belsen, Sobibor, Kelno, Theresien, Ebensee, Sachsenhausen, Ravensbrück, Gusen, Majdanek. I could go on. There were hundreds now. The last count I got from Sarah Bloomfield, the executive director over in the U.S. Holocaust Museum in Washington, a friend of mine now, maybe close to 30,000 if you count all the sub-camps all over Europe. Unbelievable amount of camps. One story was worse than the next. It was mind-boggling. It's going to be 69 going on 70 years ago, and I can feel it when I talk about it to you young people like today. It was mind-boggling then, the overwhelming enormity and the bestiality, and that's the word I use, bestiality of what I witnessed. Left a mark on me, as I said, a mark right here in my heart, my soul. I can't get rid of the mark. I wish I could, but it's there. It's embedded here. What I saw and what I witnessed. And I keep saying over and over again, how did this happen? Why did this happen? How did the free world let this happen? And I never got an answer that made any sense to me. Never. So in the memory of those 6 million, you've heard that many times, I'm sure, which include 1.5 million children like you. 1.5 million of the six were slaughtered. And the 5 million non-Jews, the Catholics, the Gypsies, the gays, Jehovah's Witnesses, all slaughtered by the Nazis. Anyone who didn't conform to Hitler's perverted ideology of Aryan perfection, you know, the white, blonde, blue-eyed, the righteous Gentiles, many of whom are good friends of mine, speak with me on the circuit, never get enough credit. If they spoke up to try to help their Jewish neighbors or friends, thrown in the camps. I'm going to just tell you a moment now about the Nuremberg War Crimes trials. I wanted to be a lawyer. So I attended the Nuremberg War Crimes Trials in the Nuremberg Palace. How the hell that place didn't... Nuremberg got bombed by a B-24s, but the palace somehow, the big palace in Nuremberg, didn't get hit. They had the Nuremberg trials. I don't know if you'll study that. If you haven't, maybe you will. Went on for almost a year, trying all these big Nazis. And this was testimony, deposition, bill of pay, all that legal stuff. I won't go. I heard it over and over again. Some people would come into the camp. They would pick out certain people, put them on an operating table, have a stopwatch nearby, start to cut, operate without anesthesia. And you will hear the screams would go out. 10 seconds, 20 seconds, 30 seconds. The screams they could hear. Till the screams stopped, the person died. And the Nazis were very big on records. They kept, to their detriment later on, they kept records of how long somebody being cut open would survive, man, age, whatever. Dr. Mengele and the other butchers. Doctors. These are kind of experiments. Men and women come into the camps. Girls like you with their mothers. Some with the babies. Teenage. The girls and mothers over here. The men and the boys over here because apparently they could work. They were certain age, 16 or above, okay. But the ladies, the mothers, the teenage. Strip. Take your clothes off to be degraded. You stand there naked in front of everybody for a couple of minutes. Now go in, you're going to be deloused. It made sense. They all had lice from the filth in the camp. And what appeared to be, we saw it, looked like showers, outside showers. And they went in, the door shut, instead of water, gas. And we saw the scratches on the walls of the girls and the mothers trying to get out. And this went on 24/7, almost to the day we came to liberate the camps. That's the cruelty. And I remember Ike told our officers, Ike was our commanding general, Dwight D. Eisenhower, later our president, everybody called him affectionately Ike. He sent down, he said, if you guys didn't know what you were fighting before, you sure as hell ought to know now. Evil. The Nazis were evil. So in the memory of all those poor souls, that's what my lieutenant called them, poor souls affectionately, who were deliberately degraded, dehumanized, tortured, slaughtered, and murdered without cause or without reason by the Nazis. I don't want you to ever forget the Holocaust. And lest I forget, and I'll never forget, memory and tribute to my own band of brothers. Every time I speak, I'm like Tex and Sully, Jason, Richie, Tony C., Schoolboy, Sarge, Rory, Wacko, Timmy, Sanchez, Mitch, Tommy. I love Tommy. And TR, I told you about. And Willie, I told you about my captain. Captain B wouldn't be here if it wasn't for my captain. You understand? I wouldn't be here because he saved our squad not once, but twice from ambush. And the second time he jumped on a live one, a grenade. And you don't come back when you jump on a grenade. And all those guys are down there. You see, I'm here. But I'm not going to forget them ever. And I don't want anybody else to forget them. Because they made it possible for you to be able to sit here in this free country and listen to me today. And they're all heroes down there, in my judgment. I wish I could bring one of them back. You know, I'd give my medals, I'd give any, but I can't, obviously. And I had guilt for a long time. I'm not going to get into all that. I don't know why I'm here sometimes. And I get used to go through these. I want to be dead like my buddies. I want to be with them. It sounds crazy to you all. I understand that. And I probably needed a shrink. But there was a rabbi, I tell you, over in Westchester a couple of years ago. When I talk like this, sometimes I get emotional. And he was behind me sitting on the bimmer. And then he put his hand, and I felt his hand on my shoulder. And he said, Alan, I think, because I was saying, is there a higher power up there? I don't know if there's a higher power. because things sometimes happen. And I wonder, there's somebody that's controlling that. I'm not that religious in a sense, but my religion is in my heart. If anybody says anything about a Jew in front of me, they better run, because that's how I feel. But and the rabbi put his hand on my shoulder and he said, I think there is a higher power, and he saved you, Alan, because you're telling the young people what you're doing here is so important. And I think he probably saved you, so he knew you were going to go out and speak on behalf of your buddy. So I try to look at it that way, you know. It gives me a little solace, I don't know how to describe it. But at any rate, I speak here today. Let me move on. I'm almost done. I'm glad that Hannah gave me a lot of time, but I've really been going at it here. But I speak here today for each one of my buddies and all those poor souls, as my lieutenant referred to them, who were slaughtered by the Nazis. They can't speak, obviously. They can't speak, but I can speak and I will speak. And I feel I'm their messenger. And I want each one of you to be my messenger. And the message is, obviously, that there was a horrific Holocaust that I told you about that occurred in Europe in the 30s and 40s. And you young people must make absolutely sure that it never, ever happens again. That's the main reason why I and all the survivors and the hidden children and the kinder transport, why we speak. So you know what happened and make sure it doesn't happen again. I believe, it's been said many times that those who choose to ignore or forget the events of the past are doomed to have the events of the past return. That's a truism. You learn from history. You know, and I think Edmund Burke had it right when he said something to the effect that all that is necessary for the triumph of evil is for good men, and of course I always add good women, good girls, not to act. I don't want you guys to be bystanders. I want you to be upstanders. I want you to speak up about what's right and what's wrong. You're old enough to know that. My generation say it to say we failed. We didn't get rid of the hate and the prejudice and bigotry that's still out there. We didn't do the job. Got this ISIS beheading people on television. The hate that they got in this country. I'm a member of the Southern Poverty Law Center. Another lawyer by the name of Morris D's friend down in Montgomery, Alabama, keeps a record of all these hate groups in this country and weeds them out if he can, destroys them. Yeah, the guy deserves so much credit, never gets enough, in my judgment. The last number I got from the Morris and Southern Poverty, there's almost 1,000 hate groups in the United States of America. With this Heil Hitler, kill the niggers, kill the spicks, kill the kikes in America today. I get excited, I get upset by it. But the truth is the truth. Subsidized by anonymous hate mongers. Let me just say to you guys, inaction to me is the same as consent. Indifference to me is the same as consent. I don't want you sitting back when you hear some, I don't know, maybe in your group you don't, but I used to hear it when I was, there's always some making remarks about, you know, the N-word, using the N-word, making fun of this group, or the Polish people are supposed to be stupid, all the Polish jokes, and the Italians are all mafiosa, all those stereotypes. Sometimes you feel uncomfortable. You know damn well if you go away, they're going to be talking about Jews too. Or you may feel uncomfortable. You don't do anything. You don't get up. You don't say anything. I want you to get up. Say, hey, knock it off. I know it's not easy sometimes, but you got to have the chutzpah, the guts to do it. That's where it starts. And the real friends that you have, they're going to say, boy, they felt the same way, and that was something what you did. So let me end on this last page. I want to just quote President Kennedy, what he said years ago, and I've forgotten. And that accent that I can't do, you know, with that southern, not the Massachusetts, wherever, New English. Mankind, whatever, huh? I better not try it. My daughter say, Dad, stop it. You. Mankind must put an end to war, or war's going to put an end to mankind. We don't have an M1 rifle war anymore. We got nuclear. And we got crazies. In North Korea and Iran, all these wackos. So let me end by trying to be a little more optimistic. I don't want to be all negative here. I hope and pray, I really do. I hope and pray there'll come a day that this hate and this prejudice and this bigotry and that I saw in the eyes of the Hitler Youth and the Waffen-SS and what's going on today, that all this garbage, that all this hate and prejudice, seeing that it'll, this lack of respect for different cultures and different religions, that all this lunacy will come to an end. That hopefully there'll come a day, in my judgment, that you can try to judge people as individuals and not as part of a group. You know, if a black person does something bad or negative, I don't want to hear. Sometimes when I was a kid, the parents would say, see, that's what they do, that's what they are. It's not they. Get away from the they word, because it's the same thing if Jewish people do something that's not kosher or steal or whatever. I don't want to hear my Gentile friends, which I have heard when they had a few drinks, and my veteran friends breaks my heart. That's what the Jews are. That's what they do. You know, they're skin stingy. They're tight. They're money hungry. That's a stereotype. Judge people as individuals. One Jewish person doesn't represent all, no more than one black person doesn't represent all the group. So I think it's, I learned that when I was a kid. People are more alike than, judge people as individuals. I'm gonna judge them by their qualities as human beings, how they relate to you and to others. And as Dr. King said, by the content of their character. Now, character is a hard word to define. It's the character. But you feel it, you sense it, you smell it. Good character. You're old enough to know that. You know friends of you that have good character or bad character. That's how you judge people, the only way. Not by the surface stuff, by their race or religion or nationality, or gender, or certainly sexual orientation today, or not certainly by the pigmentation of their skin. That's all surface stuff. And if that day comes, hopefully in my lifetime, but let's be more realistic, even in your lifetime or your children's lifetime, then maybe all God's children can live side by side, neighbor to neighbor, in peace, without the fear of there ever being another Holocaust like the hell and the horror that I personally witnessed in May of 1945. I went long. You've been very patient. You've been a good group. I appreciate it very much. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for standing. That's never got a standing. I'll look at that as a standing ovation. Yes, of course. I wonder.
Does anyone have a question they want to ask?
I'm just going to put this. Before you do it, my daughter always tells me, I used to pass out some pictures, but I found out what was bad. If I did it, people would all be looking at the photos and they wouldn't be listening to me. So now I'll pass them out. One of them is what I told you initially about the piles of skeletal bodies. I'll start one here, and then I'll give you, and you pass it back. And the other one is a gentleman that was in the barracks on a stool, can hardly see one of his arms. I'll give you an idea when I say skeletal-like. And this poor guy, 10 minutes after this photo was taken, fell off the stool and was dead. So first, this is one of the piles of a skeleton. You can pass it behind you, and I'll put it, and you can pass it behind you, or I guess you have to, there's one in the middle. I got three of these, so circulate it somehow. That's the bodies, and this is the gentleman that I told you about. You want to get an idea when I say skeleton-like. My daughter said when you see something like this, you get a better idea of what I'm trying to talk about. This was taken by an army sergeant at the camp. And now, while you're doing that, start with this young lady. First of all, you all stood up. Now I want you to stand up and ask a question.
Hi, I'm
Mimi. Mimi? Mimi. Hi, Mimi. How are you?
Very good, thank you.
I'll repeat the question after she visits.
What was your reaction when you got the draft letter?
Okay.
She wanted to know what was my reaction when I got the draft. Yeah, I want you to get this in your noggin. What the rabbi touched on a little bit. In World War II, patriotism was sky high. Everybody wanted to fight for this country, every guy that I knew. We loved this country. Our grandparents came from the old country. They instilled it in us, America, because what they went through, the ones that came over here. And when the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor, man, I wanted to go enlist. I was 15. My mother, of course, is being a nice Jewish mother, she would have cut my throat, so I couldn't do it. But as soon as, I couldn't wait to be 18. We had six guys in my fourth ward. I touched on that. I was the only Jewish kid. There was, my recollection is that the colored boy, we use the word, I don't think they got draft, no, that I recall, but I may be a little vague on that, but not, most of us, it was the Italian, two other boys that I knew, five of us played ball together. When we got the draft notice, you went for a physical. Four of us, including me, passed. We got on the bus to go to be processed. The one boy, little Italian, Tony Bedelli, he had a perforated eardrum or something. Perforated ear, you were 4F, why I never knew, but something to do that you couldn't get into the Army. And he stood outside that bus when we were going to go and be, you know, getting processed to go, crying like a baby. He wanted to go so desperately. Everybody wanted to fight for this. We love this country. And I can't emphasize that enough. So when I got the, I expected, first of all, when you're 18, you knew you were going to get the letter. It wasn't like a shock. But I wasn't upset. Hell, we didn't want to run up to Canada. I mean, we wanted to go and fight for this country. We loved the country. I can't emphasize everybody that I saw and knew. The patriotism in World War II. And I think when Broke Corn, the rabbi touched on it, called us the greatest generation. There was just something instilled in us. We got it, I think. You know what I got a lot? From my parents and grandparents. I can't speak for this group because you may, but a lot of the groups I speak to, and I used to refer to dinner time, because those days mothers cooked dinner. I don't mean every mother cooked dinner. We played out in the streets, first of all. We didn't have any television. My grandchildren, what? No video, whatever the hell, all day long. We played in the streets. The girls were doing, what is that, hopscotch, something with,
yeah,
on the sidewalk. And the boy, dinner, every mother did cook. When I used to talk about dinner time, the teachers came up to me, Mr. Moskin, I don't think they understand what, when you say your father, they don't know what they're doing. They have pizza ordered, Domino, to go out. There are this, I said, well, don't the father sit there talking about what you do in school? Now, I'm not saying you guys don't, but most of the kids look at me like vague when I talk dinner time. My father came home every fall. What did you do in school? Today? God forbid you brought a note home. Alan was acting up a little bit. And they had to say, oh man, I was, my father never hit me in his life. All he had to do was look at me and put his hand like this. Man, my heart. And my grandparents, they used to sit at the dinner table when you did, they wanted to learn English. It was the whole family together. And I used to listen to my mother talk to their parents, you know, you picked it up. But all good stuff, you know. That's missing a lot. I'm generalizing. I'm sure a lot of you get some, but a lot of the family, where's the connection? And girls, your age particularly, you got to be verbal with your mother. I hope you are, because I'm fine. A lot of girls talk to their girlfriends, but the mothers, they're working, they come home, they're tired, you know, they do this, they got their, everybody's doing in their own sphere, and then right away, but boop, boop, beep. I mean, I'm going to tell you, I went down to South Carolina, like my daughters would kill me if they were, but my both daughters moved to Charleston, South Carolina. And I like it down. I got seven grand. I married late. You know, I was playing the field, as they say, as a swinging lawyer. So all my married friends trying to fix me up. And they're all asking me what I did with the girlfriend. They looked like they were more interested in my life than their own. So I feel, why should I get married? So. I didn't get married till late, let us put it that way. I had two beautiful daughters. I got seven grandchildren. They caught off fast, but I moved out. I go down there. You know, you can see I'm a blabbermouth. Hi, Pop-Pop. Then we, what, it, the next thing is.
The dinner table?
No. The grandma says, oh, please, don't be starting up with Jack. That's my oldest daughter. She takes after me, you know, she. That's rude. I at the dinner table? My mother, my father, you put that away? No, tell, if we didn't have that, you're not, put it away. That's what you should do. I'm down there, I wanted to talk to my grand. What did you do in school today? Nope, each one of them, they think, that stupid thing in between their knees looking down. And my daughter and son, they set the example because they're schmex things or whatever they're doing. What they're doing. Even in the same house. Upstairs, he's like, yeah, come downstairs. What are they doing? This is crazy. You got to show feelings. You can't show feelings on a machine. The words don't have feelings. Okay, is that hard to get? Man, oh man, you cry, you feel joy. You talk, you get it out. Girls your age, I think, particularly need it because you're going through a certain stage. I'm not an expert, but I know enough about that. And you need to be verbal with you, but not just a machine. And I'm generalized. I'm sure there's not everybody, but I'm going to tell you what I see now is, and God forbid, even when you're not old enough to drive yet, that's horrible. Enough?
No, I want to ask a question.
Okay, I'm just saying that I see some of the people driving and doing this, you know, whatever it is, looking down, looking up. That's horrible. That's an accident waiting to happen. But there was I was going this way. Who else wants to start? Who else got questions for me? Stand up and give me a name. What? Now you see what I mean? Boy, and Pat would say, so up and loud and clear. What's your name?
That's how we talk. We didn't have that voice like I got. Rivka. That's a nice name. You should be proud of her. Hi, Rivka.
How do you feel about the 50 years of you?
How do I feel about the 50 years?
Yeah.
In what respect? What do you mean by that? Did I feel I should have talked about it before the 50 years? Yeah, probably, in retrospect. You know, I don't like to go back what you should have, could have, would have. But I had a reason for not doing it. I was scared that I was going to have nightmares that I had right after the war. So that's like I locked up did I say that?
Yeah.
I was going to lock up the bridge. I don't want to think about it. I was so scared that I was going to bring back, you know, all those shaky nightmares, crying, and I don't want to do that. In college or back home, people think I'm crazy. When you were doing it, the service guys had similar things. They knew about it. They didn't like it, but they understood it. Even today, we got a lot of people, a lot of guys with PTSD talking now more about it. They try to have a patent. It was not much for neurological disorder. If I did what he did, like he did, my captain told me, I think it got some publicity. There was a young fella in a tent ready to go to the hospital, and Patton was there with his aide. And most of these guys, you can sit down here. Most of these guys have physical injuries, you know, a bad wound, blind in an eye, an amputation. When it came to this one fellow who was, this is what I was told by my captain, who knew Patton's aide very well, was shaking like this and crying. Patton said, this is what I was... Where's your injury, soldier? Where's your injury? I'm mimicking a little bit, but he said, I can't go fight anymore. I can't go back. I can't. So when he asked the doctor, you know, where's the injury? He doesn't have a physical injury, General. He's a neurological problem. Patton didn't know about that. Took his pistol out. This is my captain told me.
pointed to the guy and said, if you don't get this, I'm not going to use the curse words, because Patton had, and I wasn't a goody-two-shoes, but he knew more four-letter words than I ever heard before. He would shout with that, cool. He gave it to the Krauts, though, they called the Nazis, but the, I'll do those Nazi. At any rate, he said, if he don't get this guy up to the front line within 24 hours, I'm going to blow his brains out right here. And he meant it. And they quickly pushed the doctor out to get the, he didn't, those days, you know, you were a malingerer. If you didn't, you know, they thought you were faking. But anybody that's been on the front line, I'm going to tell you right off, has got some kind of PTSD, some worse than others. It's not normal to see body parts flying around, see your best buddy's head go by. I mean, it's got to affect you. I don't care who you are. It's not like in the movies and the TV and all that garbage. I tell my grandchildren or my daughter, I don't want them doing that. They play the video of who's killing the most. That's garbage. I saw enough killing and hate. I don't want them even thinking that way. Oh, my daughter, they know the difference. It's only make-believe. Baloney. You got a guy like that kid from Newtown? All you need is a little wacko person who goes killing a bunch of kids because they think that doesn't know the difference. So I don't like violence. I won't touch a gun. I don't look at a gun. I'm not speaking for everybody else. That's me. I get into big eyes with the NRA and all that stuff. I don't want to see a gun out here and people gets me nervous. Connor, I'm sorry.
Yeah, I'm curious how much before you were drafted, still in high school, and as the war went on, let's say 42, 43, how much in the Jewish community were you aware of what the Jews were going through? I mean, when you were drafted, was you conscious of that? Was that part of it?
We knew that Hitler, apparently, from what you got to understand, there was nothing but newspapers then. When you got something in the movie theater, movie tone news, it was always 5 days, Lowell, you know, before. So it wasn't like today where you're updated on the news. But I knew generally from I was a teenager, that Hitler was not crazy about Jews, but not to the extent that they were in concentration camp. At least my family and me. Later on, I found that there were some people who came back, before the things got real bad, and they tried to tell their neighbors and friends that it wasn't good for the Jews there, and they suspected that things were going to get worse, but not to the extent of concentration camps, what they were doing until we, at least on our level. Now, I'm going to tell you, everybody that I knew in my neighborhood all over loved Franklin Delano Roosevelt, particularly the minority group. He was paralyzed, and he was a tremendous orator, he and Churchill. I mean, I could listen to them. I forget what they say. It's just the way they expressed it. So we loved our president. And I was in a foxhole in Amberg, I think it was, and the word was coming down. The president, you know, that you got word that way from one to the other. One fox, I think the president's dead. What? First you think, well, is it true? I asked, can I verify it with my cap? I started to cry. A lot of us did. We loved President. But then after the war, when I started reading and finding out things about FDR and was told by Morgenthau and others about the situation with the Jews, he damn well knew. Those camps were going up well, starting in the low 30s. And he knew about it and didn't do it. Something about it. And I'm not going to be a Monday morning quarterback, but the Jews were not a priority, is my judgment. There were more things that in this country that he felt. And when the St. Louis tried to land and not allowing those people to land in this country, when I heard that, my opinion, frankly, of FDR dropped quite a bit. I don't like to say it, even hear myself say it, but that's the truth. They didn't do, in my judgment, I would have, but again, what Truman did to me was an amazing thing. And if FDR would have dropped the bombs at Auschwitz, the railroad track, sure, civilians would have got killed. Civilians get killed in war, whether you like it or not. But what Truman did, and I remember we were on our way in a ship when the war ended in Europe in May of 45, After a week or so, we got on a ship. We were going to go to Japan. And again, communication wasn't like today, but we heard all of a sudden rumors that we dropped a bomb, an atomic bomb. Come on, we don't drop atomic bombs on Hiroshima. But a lot of baloney, we all said. And then, oh yeah, there was another bomb in Nagasaki. What are they talking about? The lousy rumors. And when I found out it was true, initially, I was so upset. I said, we... And then they showed, later on, pictures of what the radiation did to the, you see that even today, people going out of, bro, what? If we didn't drop the bomb at Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the Japanese culture does not believe in surrender, number one. Well, we would have had to invade the mainland after what I read up, and there would have been, if hundreds of thousands of Japanese and Americans, if not millions, in the because they wouldn't have surrendered. It would have taken God knows how long to end that war. So that was a very difficult decision at Harry Truman. When Harry Truman succeeded Franklin Delano Roosevelt, everybody said, that haberdasher is going to be a president because FDR was in such esteem. How can it? That was the initial. And I'm telling you, a lot of guys like me that we said, he did the right thing. If you're going to fight a war, to me, you got to fight it to end it and win it. You can't just keep going on and on. And I tell the media, well, don't get me started with them. I've had plenty of arguments with some of these. Never mind. What's your name?
Chenya.
Spell it.
C-H-E-N-Y-A.
C-H-E? Oh, that's unusual. Yours is Chana. Okay.
When you were fighting in the ranks and everything, did you guys know that concentration camps existed and were in, processing human?
I thought I made that clear that we didn't know anything about it. Are you asking me, did I know the concentration camps?
Yeah. Did you know that they existed?
No. You're a very pretty girl. Were you listening? I used to tell my girlfriend that sometimes. You were listening to me, but she was looking in my blue eyes.
I'm Sarah.
Hi.
Did you, after the war, did you have anyone that went through the same thing as you that you could talk to?
You mean in talking about the PTSD?
Yeah.
That's a good question. I did come across one or two of my buddies who we met after the war. We used to meet. I was in Jersey, a Jersey boy at Englewood, New Jersey, and we used to meet in Manhattan at the Astor or something. It was a hotel around 47. It was easy for Brooklyn. The five of us met there, and one or two other guys said that they were having nightmares, and they didn't want to talk to their mother and father about it because they thought they were crazy. But we didn't know where to go then. No, we didn't have, today, Jerry Donnellan is a friend. He's the head of the Veterans Affairs over in New City, and we have, we tell people, young fellows coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan, when they got the shakes, and I see their wild out, some of them are married, and their wives say, Mr. Moskin, I'm a group that helping soldiers that come back, and some of their wives say, my husband, he's not the same anymore. He's different. I said, of course he's different. He's been in combat. You got to be patient. She said he doesn't seem to love me. I can't go into all the details, but it does. When you see death all around you, some guys get destroyed by it, and they need help. And we try to give them help and send them to. I'm a member of the World War II group and the Korean guys that try to help these young guys from Iraq go where they need help and sit down and talk to the shrinks or whatever. I shouldn't use that term, but that's an old World War II. Psychiatry is important in many cases to get it out. Some of them keep everything inside, and that's not good. And they unfortunately take it out on their. Who do you take it out on? You always take it out on your loved ones. Because poor guys take it on their wives, sometimes on their children. And I just tell the wives to try to be patient. And anytime they want to call me or, I'll do the best I can. I'll speak to their husband or whatever. I've been there, done that. And so if you come in contact with anybody in your own experience, you have to understand that sometimes some are affected more than others, you know. But again, it's not a movie and it's not a TV. As I said initially, being in combat is like being a hell and back. Even when I talk about it today, it brings back a lot of, I guess you felt my emotion. I can't help it. That's how I feel about things. Yes, there's a hand there. Get up. Loud and clear. What's your name?
Mushka.
Spell it.
M-U-S-H-K-A.
Yeah, Mushka.
Repeat the question.
Did your family stay in New Jersey during the whole war?
Yes. Yes, in Englewood, New Jersey. My father was a pharmacist, and was a councilman in the 4th Ward, and then became the mayor of Englewood for many years. Yeah, those days, a lot of the people would go to the pharmacist. They couldn't afford a doctor. So when I was a teenager, I used to help my father out a little bit. They used to call him Doc. I said, why are they calling you Doc? You're not a doctor. But that was just a thing. And they would ask him, instead of going to the doctor where they had to pay, what do you got? Mayor Moskin, what's good for the... So my father used to say, Rabbi, sometimes he'd give him a sugar pill. That meant that, I got something good. A lot of times, some of the patients, he knew them. It was like a hypochondriac. Said, oh, Mayor. So he would go, I got the best thing. The next day, so I would even be after school. I'd be. What was that? What a unbelievable! I feel 100%. You're the best, Mr. Mayor Moskin. And I used to say later. I always had my father say, "Don't you laugh?" See, I was like you. I was ready to say, "You stupid! It was a sugar pill." You can't be doing that. I was going to tell them, make a joke, but it was funny how a lot of that is in your mind. But, you know, they didn't have the doctors in those days. By the way, you know what, doctors? You're older. When I was a kid, my mother once went to Dr. Phillips. They had a doctor that was, those days, there were no specialties. Doctor did everything. And I was downstairs in his house, 7:30 in the morning. I think they didn't call it the flu. Grip, was there any other word? Grip, something was the grip. I don't know what the grip, to me a grip is a grip. But it was a different grip. I think two P's and an E. Got the grip. But the point I'm making, the $2. A doctor visit was, my mother said, $2? So much money. $2 was for the office visit that she rest in peace. I always kid my mother later. We laugh like you're laughing about all these old times. And you ever hear of Sammy's Romanian? You guys know anything about that over in New York? It's when we used to have a celebration, the food was, but I can't even remember the what's the stuff, the stuff that can, it's got lower when you, the height, the cholesterol. My mother used to pour that, mashed potatoes used to put, later on I found out, you're killing me with this thing. It's the worst for your heart and everything. And Sammy's Romanian was the place they used to go, and one thing after another was with all this. I can't. My mother would be laughing like you do if she was here. But they didn't know the butter. My mother would, mashed. The more the butter, that was the best. And the bakery, more the butter than the. Where's the butter in here? It's just things that change completely now.
I was reading in our World War II textbook that Patton, when he liberated one of the camps, he was very distasteful of the Jews that they liberated, and he would set up guards around them, and he put up barbed wire, and he would just treat them very harshly. Did you witness any of that?
I didn't witness any of that. That was a good question. I have heard that quite a bit. I can't speak for that, because first of all, I was a young soldier, and I didn't get into that much contact, but my officers never told me that. But after I got out of the service, I want to... I got to get the book Killing Patton by Bill O'Reilly. Somebody told me that I could probably relate to a lot of stuff in there. I'm not a big Bill O'Reilly for politics, but I'm going to get the book. I want to read it. But I heard that quite a bit, that they felt that Patton had exhibited the forms of anti-Semitism. A lot of the Jewish friends tell that to me, but in a very
All I can tell you is what I experienced. So I can't speak to something I don't know about. I never heard it. My officers never said anything. I never got any feeling of anti-Semitism from anybody. If they felt that way inherently, I can't speak to that. But I did hear that, what you just talked about, that there was evidence that he was anti-Semitic. All I can tell you is that when he saw the bodies, those skeleton-like bodies, all, you know, blood and guts was supposed to be such a strong general, which he was. He ran into a men's room and his aide ran behind him because the aide had to stay with him and he vomited all over the place. He got so upset looking at those bodies. And that's when Eisenhower and Bradley and Patton went to Ordruff. That was one of the camps earlier that was liberated. And they, you know, this is what kills me. We got these photos and I can show you photos. By the way, did I yeah. Oh, you got them back there, all of them? Good. What did I see? This is what happens. When you get 88 now, I lost track by doing that. And I forgot what I was. Where was I leading to? Ordruff was one of the first concentration camps that were liberated, yeah. And he threw up all over the place.
You were saying something about this is what killed me. You were saying something.
About Eisenhower. Well, Eisenhower, I thought I mentioned that already, said that he knew about the evil we were fighting when he saw all this stuff. And by the way, well, you guys probably do the internet. Eisenhower, I got to give a lot of credit. I never thought him as a very heavy intellectual, as a president, let's put it that way. Nice guy, nice, you know, everything else. But we heard him say, right then, there early, my captain said that, I always say Ike because everybody would call him Ike, that Ike brought the word down. I don't want my guys picking up those bodies. We were allowed to touch those bodies. We had to bring in people from town, let them see, look at the bodies, Germans and some of the prison, the German guards from the prisons in town, Wells, Austria, and Linz, and they would come in like this. And then when they... I remember when they were asked about they didn't know it. Now I'm not going to put judgment on the people, but within a few kilometers. But the smell, we smelled that thing kilometers before we got there. The smokestacks, the buses and the trains are taking all their Jewish neighbors. Oh, I have to believe that you got your face in the sand if you don't say you didn't have any idea. I think. They had to know something was going on, but it got so bad that I think sometimes, you know, you don't want to know, you close your eyes and ears. They all said they didn't know anything about it. They didn't know about the camps, they know about the Jews. But I really can't believe that completely. But Eisenhower, what I started to say, he said right away, get it down, take pictures. Someday some SOBs are going to say this was so horrific, so terrible, the Jews made it up, and that this is a lie. And he put, that's been all, my daughter said, that's been all over the internet, that what Eisenhower said came true. That today, even today, a guy like Ahmadinejad, Mel Gibson's father, and these other anti-Semites, you could show them in black and white, the photos, the testimony by me, all the survivors, all the GIs, Jews and Gentiles, not just Jews. And they still say, no, it didn't happen. It's a fib. I mean, that's how strong their anti-Semitism has to be, that you can show them in black and white, they deny it. Loud. Is anybody here called June or Molly? Or I'm making fun. I'm not making fun. Don't mind me. I can't. How do you spell it?
H-E-N-S-E.
Okay, that's not too bad. I never heard that one before.
It's Yiddish.
Well, okay. I apologize.
After you were done, the war, did you have to work, or they?
I got back, I was 20, I went back to Syracuse. I didn't say that, I'm sorry. I went back to Syracuse. When I finished up in Syracuse, I had
you know, finish up at Syracuse in 1946 when I went back. And in 1948, I went to New York University Law School and graduated there with a JD degree in 1951. Practiced law in Bergen County, Jersey for a trial lawyer for 20 years. A lot of lawyers didn't like to go to trial and they couldn't settle a case. They would refer it to yakkers like me who like to get in front of a jury, and I love that part of it. It's not like you guys watch Law and Order and all those television. You know, it's always the next day they're in court. Believe me, it doesn't happen that way. It's a couple of years with the depositions and a bill of particulars, all the legal. And we didn't have paralegals. Paralegals today do a lot of the what I call the legwork, interviewing witnesses. It's a good show. You guys get older. It's not a bad. One of my daughters did that a little bit. It's not a bad job. You can become a lawyer if you want. You get a smell of what law's all about. They give you a pretty decent salary being a paralegal today. But they do all the dirty work that I had. I didn't like that, but I like to get in front of picking the jury. I got the right guy that's going to, you know, it's like a game. You see 12 people that pick who's going to be the one that's going to be powerful. And I would look the guy in the eye and then I found out like that palooka went the other way. So you never can tell, but it was a game to me. Now they have experts doing that too. You want to be a lawyer, by the way. They don't even allow you to pick the jury with it specially. They get a lady, a man sits there, a black, a Protestant, a Catholic. They do all the stuff. I don't want that. I like it. It's a game, you know. I like to do it myself. See, I'm getting off the track again. I'm sorry. You had the question already. Oh, don't they? Everyone ends with an A or a U or a...
When you went to liberate the camps, were the Nazis there?
There was only one in the camp that I touched on that, but there was one SS soldier that wouldn't drop his gun at Gunskirchen. Yeah. And I thought that I don't brag about it, but I had a... give him a few in the belly. And I had to kill the one Nazi that I kept hearing the interpreter telling him, I forget how it was, but, you know, drop the gun. And the captain finally said, I don't know why he picked me out, but told me to do my job, and I had to kill that guy. And as I said, I thought I said that, but maybe I didn't. No, that's the only one I saw. The rest of those cowards ran. It was near the end of the war, and they were retreating and running away a lot. And by the way, we were taking a lot of prisoners also because the Nazis didn't want the Russians to get them, because the Russians weren't taking them prisoners. They were killing them all. They had real animosity, the Russians, toward the Germans.
Okay, so how is it like?
What was your name?
Deborah.
Spell it.
D-E-B-O-R-A-H.
Like Deborah.
Oh. Yeah. But I had an aide over in, I mean, one that when I went over to with the March of the Living. Do you know, there's a group called the March of the Living. Years ago, they said, Mr. Mosk, we want you to come and show them. I went to Poland and Israel. Her name was Devorah. Is yours?
That's
how we, and I think she spelled it a little like that.
Yeah.
You didn't, but you didn't say Devorah, did you?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
What did you say?
Devorah. Yeah, same name.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I thought you said Deborah. Okay.
So how is it to, transition into everyday life? Like you say, you just went back to university. Like, how did that work?
Say it again. Without the hands. I'm a big one with the hands too.
How is it to transition back to everyday, like from the army to everyday?
How did I adjust or what did I do?
It was difficult, I try to say, in the beginning. My mother said that she heard me a few times. You got to remember, I was 20 when I got back in England, before I went back to Syracuse. I got back in July of 46, started Syracuse in September. So 2 months I was home in summer. She said I used to scream once in a while, but I told her, if I do that, Mom, don't get upset or excited. I don't know what I did. But the one thing I did, and I don't remember, but she said I used to open the refrigerator door and stand there and just keep looking at it. And I remember, but she said, I just used to stare. And I kept thinking back, well, it may be because, you know, it was something different or there was food in there or something, but it was psychological. But she said she used to look at me, you know, peek around the corner when sometimes 2 or 3 in the morning, I would just, you know, standing there half naked and opening the refrigerator door and looking, but not taking anything out. Maybe it was just to be sure that there was going to be food in there or something. I can't answer that. I'm not my own psychiatrist, but that's a few weird things that I did, but I got over that. When I went up to Syracuse in the fraternity, I was Phi Ep. They don't have that, by the way. I had a great time with fraternity, with sororities, all that bit. As a president of the fraternity, those were good times. Good party school, Syracuse, if you think about it. But I used to do a couple of crazy things, you know. I don't know what the heck. I can't even remember. The guys told me that. I don't even want to think about it, because I guess I was a weirdo for a while. But I didn't do that with the girls. I was pretty good with the girls. I don't think I didn't frighten them off. But next, as we get, am I going overtime? I sure am, boy. You got me here almost 2 hours.
Girls, we've got another speaker coming in.
You got another speaker? I'm sorry.
So, and I really want to express our gratitude.
This is when I was a kid, when I was a scout. Which one?
Are you on the
left or the right? Yeah, that's me, that's mine.
This is your friend?
You both did that? The scouts. I had some hair, and I got bald. What the hell happened? And I told you, I'm an amateur boxer, and my nose has been busted 20. You know, I don't want to get into all that. But better looking when I was a kid. Another speaker, I got to get out of here. Go to me one favor. If you can, Rabbi, Mensahana. I never ask for a fee, honorarium, but if you can somehow make a donation to the Holocaust Museum in my honor, it would be very much appreciated.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate it. God bless. How was it outside, the snow?
I drove from Morristown. It was okay.